Okay, we are in Perek Yuches, chapter 18. And in this saga of the idol of Micha, the story began again with Micha having money in his possession that had been with his mother, and she thought it was stolen. He says, I took it. Whether that means I stole it or I had it legitimately is unclear. But she had cursed whoever had it. Now she gives him a bracha, and she says that it should be used for Pesel u'trafim, right? A statue and trafim. We noted that it's unclear what trafim are. Are trafim idolatrous, or are trafim some kind of a magical talisman? And in general, there are two ways to read this story as you go through it. One way to read this story is that what they end up creating with this money, after some back and forth, is an avodah zara. It's actually an idol, and Micha's house in which it is worshipped is a house of avodah zara. And then when Micha gets himself a Levi to serve as the Kohen in this house, it's actually for avodah zara. That's one take. The other take is that it was not idolatrous to begin with. Rather, trafim are some kind of a talisman that they believed could tell the future, and they thought that you could serve God that way in tandem with these pagan practices, and you would still be ultimately serving Hashem. And again, this Levi who gets involved in the service of God, but patched together with practices of the pagans around them, and not so much directly Avodah Zarah. It's actually, I mentioned that it was Rashi who said that when you see the name Aleph Lamed He Yun Mem here, it's almost always Chol. It's referring to an idol, except for when he talked about the house of Elohim in Shiloh, which is the Mishkan. So it's actually, it's a Gemara in Shavuos. I finally had a chance to look and I saw it. It's Shavuos Lamed He. But anyway, those are the two different takes that you have on the story. So Micha, last week, got himself a Levi. There was a Levi who had been living in Beit Lechem Yehudah. He was subsisting, it seems, on the strength of his being a Levi, being paid for Levi services, which basically means teaching. And after a while, he's not making enough money there, and so he goes traveling for a place where he can find support. He happens to go through this area, and he's invited into the house of Micha. Micha welcomes him in, takes care of him, and says to him, you know, wouldn't it be great to have you as my Kohen? And it was unclear whether he went along with it from the start, whether he was, you know, happy with the idea from the start, or whether he had to be talked into it. But what is clear is that at the end of the story, that's what happens. He is now Micha. I'm out of sheets at this point, so if people can share, that would be great. So what happens at this point is that Micha now has an anonymous Levi working in his house. By the end of the story, we will know who this Levi is, or have some sense of who this Levi is, but that's what we have at this stage. And that brought us to the beginning of Perek Yuches, chapter 18. And we read the psukim, we read through the psukim last time as an introduction. We talked about Dan's portion in the land. The natural portion in Israel of Shevet Dan, the one that they got in Yehoshua Perek Yutet, seemed to be in the southwest. If you picture where Aza is, that's basically their land. There is nobody south of them among the Jews. East of them is Yehuda. The east to the southeast is Yehuda. And then you have Menashe also east of them, and you work your way north, you find other Shvatim, but they are the southwest corner of the, as it is usually read. I'm looking now over your shoulder here at the Art Scroll one, and the Art Scroll one actually thinks that Yehuda extends beneath Dan.
Yeah.
So there will be differences of opinion on whether Yehuda is south of Dan. I highlight it because it's going to matter with what we're going to see today. Unclear whether Yehuda is south of it or whether Yehuda is not south of it. Yes, that was the map I gave from last year.
We talked about this a lot.
Yeah. Yes. So, and there on that map, it should be that there's no one south of them, correct?
Oh, no. Then who's all the way at the bottom?
Right.
No, because that's Plishti held land and it wasn't distributed.
That was like a portion.
Yeah. So, either way, whether there is anyone south of them or not isn't really the point directly, but they decide that we are going to go take land that is north, on the eastern side of the Yarden in the area called Bashan. That's the land that they're going to take. And we discussed last time whether this is part of their portion or whether this was something that they just decided they wanted to do arbitrarily. And of course, we had different points of view. You had the view of Radak and apparently Rashi that this was actually part of their portion. They had two pieces of land in different sections. That's just the way it is. Whereas Radak brings another point of view, and this is the Tudat David actually as well, and that is this land isn't even Israel. They conquer extra land. And that matters a great deal because you're not supposed to conquer the land outside until you first have taken care of your basic nachala, your basic portion. And why did they decide that they were going to venture north when they hadn't taken care of their land already to the south? Okay. So that brought us to the opening psukim, which we read through already. I'm going to read through them now as we explain them.
Question.
Yeah.
Is Micha a shofet?
No. There is no melech.
Story.
We started the story by saying there is no melech in Israel. Micha is just random guy. That was one of the explanations that we gave for why this story is at the end. Meaning we gave all these explanations. Almost everybody believed this story took place in the beginning of the period of the Shoftim, before Asniel ben Kenaz becomes Shofet. And that led to the question of why is this stuck at the end of the book? And one of the answers was because the previous stories all dealt with Shoftim, and now we're talking about what happens in the periods when there are no Shoftim. So this story in Pilagish Begiva is when there is no Shofet. This is just random guy. So look at Yud Ches Aleph 18:1. We get a reiteration of the lack of authority. By Yemim Ahim, in those days, Ein Melech B'Yisrael. There is no king, and no king includes no shofet. By Yemim Ahim, Shevet Hadanim Mevakesh Lo Nachala LaShebes. At that point, the people of Dan were looking for a place to settle. Kilo Nafla Lo Adayom Ahu B'Soch Shiftei Yisrael B'Nachala. Literally, it had not fallen to them until that point. A lot among the tribes of Israel. I don't know what that clause meant. I just translated it. What does that mean? They had not gotten a portion until then. So first, let's go back a step and ask the question of what you mean when you say there is no authority. We already said there was no authority. We started the story by saying that there was no authority, right? That was in Yud Zayin Vav, right? 17:6, we already said there was no authority. So what are you adding here by saying, once again, there is no authority? So the simple read, right? The simple read of why we're saying there is no authority is because, hello, Jews are worshipping idols. That's a bad thing. And so we want to say that had there been a melech, this wouldn't have happened. Right? As the Malbim says in source number one on your sheet, Gama Sipur Sheavo Po, the story we're about to read as well, Hayasi Baso Mitzad She'in Melech Otzer Ba'am, was because there was no king who could lead the nation, Shem Hay, or to prevent them from doing things that they shouldn't do. Shem Hayalahem Melech, Lohayah Shevet Mi'Israel of Dim Avodah Zarah. Had there been a king, no Israelite tribe would have worshipped idols. Now, notice what he refers to here. Not Micha worshipping idols, but by the time we're done with this story, a tribe is going to be worshipping Avodah Zarah. Or involved in syncretism, again, depending on how you explain what's going on. So Malbim says, the reason why it reiterates this is because we said it first, initially, to talk about how it was that Micha ended up setting up a house of Avodah Zarah, and now it's reiterating it because actually all Shevet is going to be involved in this. That's what he says. However, there are other takes as to what we're trying to highlight here. Source number two, Mitzudat David says, Kiyem haya melech, hayahu lochem melchamos ha'am im kolamo, velo shevet levad. He points to the fact that Dan is just doing this thing alone. They're going to take the land alone. So, as far as he's concerned, what we're highlighting here is the fact that there's no king, and therefore the Shevatim have to go off on their own, and they don't have help from anybody else. There's no central authority to get them assistance from others. Now, the truth is, even when we had Shoftim, they still didn't help each other. Right? Devorah is case in point. She's very angry at the Shevatim that don't show up for their war with Canaan. But that's the way Mitzudat David reads it.
Is the tribe of Dan being criticized for...
Yes. Oh, no, not yet. In the next line, they're going to be criticized. Barbanel is going to criticize. Mitzudat David thinks that they're just taking a share in the land and doesn't necessarily... Although he does believe it wasn't Israel at all, but he doesn't necessarily view this as a mistake. Yeah.
Yes, but it still doesn't answer the question to me. I mean, they did have an area, as we just said.
Right.
So I thought the question was, so why is it saying they didn't have a story?
Right. So I'm going to
put an extra word in parentheses.
Sorry?
The English translation adds an extra word. It says they didn't have an adequate heritage.
Right. So they're cheating. We're not there yet.
Right.
They're taking Rashi's view, which they usually do.
First two, they don't really address that.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Correct. But Abarbanel gives you a third explanation, which is just going to increase your question about why they can't make do with what they have. Abarbanel in source number 3 says Vahayara Uy Shebne Dan Yichpashu Es Eretz Nachal Asam. They should have taken their own land. Avalo Yatzu Mikvul Hanachala Lakachas Eretz Asher Lo Yatzu Mikvul Hanachala Lakachas Eretz Asher Lo Lahem. They're not supposed to leave their property to go off and get somebody else's land. Aval Asuze Lefisha Bayamim Ahim Lo Hayim Melech B'Shofet Al Yisrael. But he says he didn't have a king. He didn't have a judge. Shim Chebi Adam to protest. They weren't afraid of anybody, so they said, we want to get this land instead. We like it up north. So that's the third view. So all of them are basing themselves on the fact that you needed to repeat that there is no authority. Something new must be happening here that demonstrates lawlessness, and it's either the idolatry of Dan, first take, or the fact that Dan has to fight alone for their land. They don't have the help of other Shvatim. Or it's the fact that they're going to take land that's not part of what had been distributed to them, and this is itself a sign of deterioration. So Alina asks, why did they go north anyway? What's the goal of going north? So that Mikra edition mirrors what we saw from Malbim earlier, and we saw it in Yehoshua Yates. I didn't bring you all the sources on this on the sheet. The truth is I could have. I had room, but I didn't think I had room. But in source number 4, I just gave you a quick bullet point list of the reasons why they would go north. The Malbim's reason is because they couldn't hold their land. When the Pasuk says, Lo naflalo, it hadn't fallen to them, it means it hadn't fallen to them. Meaning, they hadn't conquered it. They were not successful, and they said, you know what? It's really hard to fight the Plishtim here. Let's just go north. Because one of the things we will emphasize when they get to this other land is that it's undefended. So that fits with the read that the Malbim has, and the Dan Mikra likes that as well.
So this was the whole tribe. There wasn't a split.
Correct. It's not like a Menashe, you're on this side, you're on this side.
So where are they living in town now if they haven't conquered it yet? Where
keep in mind, most people believe this is in the beginning of the period of the Shoftim.
So half of them, they're still on their side? Or they're just...
No. This is when everybody's trying to settle their land. They're having a really hard time, and they say, you know, enough of this. There's land up there that no one's living in. We're good with that.
Would that also depend on how the configuration is? Like, if there's someone to the south of them, it would seem like, why can't you hold it? But if they are on the bottom... then they're at the border, and it might be harder for them to take that portion?
Theoretically, yeah. Plus, the Plishtim, we know, are tough.
Yeah. Is it a large portion up north?
So it's hard to tell, because we don't get boundaries.
But did anyone else conquer any Plishtim land? Any of the other tribes?
The question is at what point the Plishtim really rose to power? Meaning, we didn't see the Plishtim discussed at all in the first half of this book. Which is what lends itself to the idea maybe this story really is later. The Plishtim really seem to gain power somewhere midway through this entire section. But we know that Yehuda has dealings with the Plishtim. We know Dan, the part that is down there, has dealings with the Plishtim in the times of Shimshon. And they're not necessarily all that successful. So you could look at it and say that this is actually a systemic problem. It wasn't just Dan's problem. Rashi's view, which is mirrored in Radak, mirrored in Mitzudat David, is that they didn't have enough land there. We noted last week, Dan is the second largest tribe at the end of the period of the Midbar. So, maybe the answer really is, their portion is insufficient for them. The weakness in that is, why would God give them land that isn't good enough for them? We've had other cases back in Yehoshua. We had cases where tribes protested and said, we don't have enough land. And they were told by Yehoshua, well, that's because you haven't conquered the land you have. Stop asking for more and do something about what you have. So, unclear, but that's a second view. And as you note, they adopt Rashi's view, because they always do. I'm not upset. The third idea, though, which Abarbanel and Malbim express, is that they are off to the southwest, and they feel like they're not really in with everybody else. Take a look back at 18.1, Yudches Aleph, and tell me where they see that in the Pasuk.
I'm sorry, what was the question?
the idea that Abarbanel and Malbim express, that the problem is that they don't have, they're not really in with everybody else. They feel like they're off on their own.
B'tol
Shivtei Yisrael, right? It said they had not gone in, B'tol Shivtei Yisrael among them. So they decide, you know, we're going to strike out on our own. The problem with that is that the new land that they're taking is also not with everybody else. It's way up north. And, you know, why go there if that's your problem? Okay, but those are the three explanations that are given for why they needed to get additional land. So they say, all right, we're going. Vayishlechu, pasuk bet. Vayishlechu v'nei dam mimishpachtam, chamisha anashim miktsosam. They send out from their families five men from their katzeh. What is a katzeh?
The edge.
Sorry, the edge, the extreme. Right, so Abarbanel says it's like kitzinim, leaders. But they pick five people of standing. And it's mimishpachtam, which the various commentators render as they took from different families, meaning like with the Meraglim, one per tribe. So they try to get equal representation. There's a diplomatic aspect to this to make sure everyone's going to be happy. Anashim b'nei chayo, people of some either strength or wealth, however you want to translate chayo, mitzara ume eshtao, which we've talked about already as, you know, a primary area in Dan, / Yehuda. They send them, l'rakel esha'aretz ulechokra, to spy out the land, to investigate. Vayamru alehem, and this is what they said to them, l'chu chikru esha'aretz, go spy out the land. Vayavo Har Ephraim, they come to Har Ephraim, because that's centrally located and everybody goes to Har Ephraim, Ad Beis Micha, to the house of Micha, Vayalen Sham, Vayalinu Sham, and they rested there. Hema in Beis Micha, sorry?
Was it like a hotel? I didn't understand. Like,
so it seems like it. It seems that Micha is a guy with hospitality.
Like
they took money, yeah. Yeah. No, and the Gemara is going to pick up on that. The Gemara is going to pick up on this.
Was the Beit Elohim, so.
Well, you know, you also need a place to live, right? Yeah. They had an attachment. It's not such a bad idea, virtual, to have a hospitality suite, you know.
And this is the hero.
So this is what they, and we're going to talk about this more in terms of the hospitality aspect, but yes, I guess he can bring in worshippers in this way. A little Chabad house there up in on Beit Ephraim. So,
on top of the mountain.
Yeah, well,
remember,
look,
Leonard,
that's where they got to be. So Hema in Beis Micha. They're in Beis Micha. The Hema Yikiru as Kol Hanar HaLevi. And they recognize the voice of this Levi. And they go and say to him, Vayasurusham, they go to him, Vayomrullah, and they said to him, Mi havyacha halom, who brought you here? Umata oseb bazeh, what are you doing here? Umalachafo, what is there for you here? So, we already asked questions when we read this last time. What's the obvious question here? Yeah, how do you know this Levi? Where did that come from?
Where did
that
come
from? Right.
He just performed
at the concert.
Yeah, like, well, how do you know this Levi? And then not only how do you know this Levi, but look at the questions that they ask. It's like very nosy. Three questions in a row here, right? Who brought you here? What are you doing here? And what is there for you here? I don't even understand the difference between the second and the third question. So, first of all, in terms of how they recognize him, Abarbanel doesn't think they necessarily recognize him per se. They just hear him singing in front of the idol or speaking, and they can tell that, you know, this is a Levi somehow. I don't know how they would. Maybe he does think that they know him. It's unclear. Abarbanel does not make it clear. Yechezkel Kaufman, though, in his work on Shoftim, has a very interesting idea. He floats the idea that Levium had a particular speaking style. As the educators, maybe they had a particular dialect or a particular form of speech that was unique to them. So they knew that this was a Levi. But the most interesting idea to me comes out of Malbim. If you remember the end of Yehoshua, when we were finishing up the division of the land, we had cities that were given to the Levium. And the way it was divided up was among the families of the Levium. So you have Gershon and his group, and Kehas and their group, and Rari and their group, and they're all in different places. Kehas, in particular, is close to the center, because Kehas is Moshe's family. and therefore it's also Aaron's family, and therefore you have all of your people who do the main work in the Beis HaMikdash there, so they want to be centrally located. Gershon is not, no. Gershon, Kahasim, Levi has three sons. Gershon, Kahasim, Merari. Kahas has four sons, Amram, Yitzhar, Hebron, and Uziel, and Amram's kids are Moshe, Aaron, and Miriam. So you're all out of the line of Kahas. Moshe has a son named Gershon.
Yeah.
Right, but this isn't that. That's the different person. No, Gershon, Kahas, and Merari are Levi's sons. So take a look at source number five. Look what Malum says. It's brilliant. He says, Achasha Levi Hazeh Hayam Ibnei Kahas. This Levi was from Kahas. How do you know that? He's Mibnei Moshe, because he's a descendant of Moshe. Kabbalah's Chazal, like the Gemara Bava Basra that we saw last week, that suggests that he's Moshe's grandson. Well, Bnei Kahas, they get their cities in the region of Ephraim, Dan, and the western half of Manasseh. So therefore, this Levi was from one of the Levite cities in Dan, and Lachenikiru. That's how they knew who he was. He actually was from Dan. He had been living in Beit Lechem Yehuda, but his point of origin, Beit Lechem Yehuda is not a Levite city. He had left the Levite city in search of subsistence. He needed support. But he's originally from there, and so they say to him, wow, we haven't seen you in ages. You know, where have you been? How'd you get here? And they ask three questions. So Abarbanel takes these three questions in a straightforward way. Mi aviyacha halom, who brought you here? Ma ta'oseh bazeh, what are you doing here? Meaning, why is there a Levi in a house of either Avodah Zarah or syncretism? This isn't what Levium are supposed to be doing. Right? They ask, like, why are you here? And malachafo, what do you have here? Meaning, how are you supported here? How is it that you're making a living? You know, hanging out in the house of Avodah Zarah. How are you getting by in Micha's house? That's a Barbanel, and that's, I think, a straight read. But the Gemara in Bava Basra, the same Gemara that identifies this Levi with Moshe's descendant, says that actually each of these questions can be associated with Moshe. What the Gemara is bothered by is the wordiness of these questions. You have three different questions, and why don't you just have them asked? You know, what are you doing here? And be done. So the Gemara says, look at the wording in the questions, and I brought you in italics a Hebrew word for each question, and you'll see why. Amrulo, they said to him, Lav mi Moshe ka'asis, aren't you from Moshe? Dichsiv be al tikrav halom. The pasuk with Moshe says, al tikrav halom, at the burning bush. Don't draw near. And the question, the first question is, mi haviyacha halom? Who brought you here? That's number one. Number two, they ask, Lav mi Moshe ka'asis, are you not from Moshe? Dichsiv be ma ze biadecha. Aren't you from Moshe, of whom it says, Ma ze, what is ze in your hand? Right, that's a reference to the staff, right, to the staff. So here, their second question was, Ma ta'ose ba ze. What are you doing with ze? And then third, Lavi Moshe ka'asis, aren't you from Moshe? Dichsiv be ve'ata po amodi madi. The pasuk says regarding Moshe, you here stand with me, po, and they asked him here, Malacha. So you get the association. To ask a Kohen Lavodah Zarah.
Hello, then you make a tie together. There's a very common word.
First of all, they're not common. First of all, they're not halom.
Halom.
Halom is a rare word.
Ko and ze.
Right. Except that it's odd to get three for three on this. It's odd to get three words in these questions that all match Moshe. But more to the point, that's not what's bothering the Gemara. What the Gemara is really bothered by is, why do you have three questions? Why isn't this all just one question? What are you doing here?
And it covers everything. That's why you say, aren't you from Moshe? What are you doing here? And just say it. Why have to hint around?
So Or asks an important question, which goes a little bit back to what we said last time, but really is what we're going to say next week. So you're covering 3 weeks. Which is, why, if that's really their question, why don't you just say so? If they're asking, what are you doing here? You're Moshe's grandson. That would make a much more interesting pasuk. To which the answer may be, what the Gemara is going to say, we're going to see it next week inside the text itself, that the text here tries to hide the fact that he's descended from Moshe. if you jump ahead for a second, we saw this last week, but it's worth taking a look. Look at Pasuk Lamed, sentence 30. We'll note it again. Look at his name. Pasuk Lamed, middle of the sentence. Yonasan ben Gershom ben... It says Menashe. Still in Perek Yuches. It says Yonasan ben Gershom ben Menashe with the Nun elevated. So the way that the Gemara explains it, and again we have to come back to this, is that he's really the son of Gershom, the son of Moshe. Gershom is Moshe's son, not Gershom, Kehas, and Rari, different, but he is Moshe's grandson. But the Anshei Knesset HaGedola, when they write this, don't want to say that Moshe's grandson became a priest for Avodah Zarah. And so therefore they conceal it by throwing in the Nun. Again, there's more to be said about this. We have to come back to this next week. It's a fine story about children who don't listen to their grandparents. But I would answer you that it could be that that's all they said to him. It could be that what they actually said was, "You're Moshe's grandson. What are you doing here?" But that in compiling the Sefer, the Anshei Knesset HaGedola, the Great Assembly, looks at this and says, "You can't put that in here. We're hiding the fact that it's Moshe, and so we're just going to put in a hint by using words that are associated with Moshe." Maybe. Okay. Either way, they ask him these three questions, and they get a three-part answer. Vayomer aleihem, he says back to them, kazo v'chaze asa li micha. Micha did such and such for me. Vayizkereini, and he hired me. Vayhilo l'chohen, and I have become a kohen for him. So, Abarbanel notes, you're answering all three questions, right? You want to know who brought me here? Micha brought me here. You want to know how I survive here? Micha pays me. You want to know what I'm doing here? I act as a kohen. So he takes care of the different questions with this, a little bit out of order, but that's okay. But you could also read it the way we talked about it last time. We had this question of whether Micha was able to get the Levi on board right away, because it says that Micha offered this to him, and then it said he left, Vayelech, and then it said that he decided to stay with the man, and we were confused. And one way to read it was Vayelech didn't mean he left. It means he went inside. But the other way to read it was that actually over time he was drawn in, first by support, and then he stays and becomes like a son, and then eventually he becomes the Kohen. And so you see that reflected here in his statement. He says, "This and this Micha did for me, and he hired me, and I became the Kohen for him." Either way, the people of Dan are here. The people of Dan have met this Levi, who they may have known beforehand. And then, apparently, they're good with the idea that he is serving this way. Even if they were surprised, they're okay with it. Because they ask him for his services. Pasuk Hey. Vayomru lo, they said to him, Sha'al na ve'elokim. Ask of Elokim, again, now this is either God, or this is the powerful trafim that they have that they use to tell the future. But ask of this, we want to know, are we going to succeed as we travel on the road? Right? Unclear. Radak, Abarbanel are very unclear about what they're doing, whether this is idolatry or not idolatry. It's not at all clear.
They seem to accept him as a Kohen here and just ask some questions.
Yep. Yeah, and look at his response. The Kohen, that's the way he identified, says to them, L'chula shalom, go to peace, all good. Nocha Hashem darkechem asher telchuva, your path is before God. Rashi says, it means he's saying, your path is known before God, and therefore magic is nothing. He's being very pious. Other ways to take it, but basically he says, things are going to be good, don't worry about it. So what we've seen in this section is that Dan is unhappy with their land, and they venture north. They meet Micha, and they ask Micha for guidance about what's happening to them. And there's no king, which leads to either idolatry or an inappropriate land grab, or a Shevet having to fight alone for the land. Okay, so that brings us to Psukim Zayin to Yud, sentences 7 to 10, yeah. Yeah.
Does anyone park in front of the Gazner house, you know, like on the street? Because they're collecting the garbage, and she just texted me that
They're not going to have a garbage can. Oh, I'm sorry, it's on the tape.
Is that on the same side as you?
Yes. Yeah.
So,
might be me.
You might want to check it.
So what you,
if you're blocking the, if you're blocking.
Is it the house with the sofa?
All right. So back to our story. We are now up to Psukim Zion to Yud, 7 to 10. This is the dull part of the parak. This is the part that doesn't involve idols and it doesn't involve a Levi and it doesn't involve Micha. This is just them going to Laish, but it's a very important part in terms of teaching us what the Jews are like at this stage. So take a look. Vayelchu chamesha sa'anashim vayavou Laisha. The five men go to Laish. Laish is the name that we're using for this right now. It was actually called Leshem in Yehoshua Perek Yetet. We're going to come back to that. But they go to Laish. They see that the nation there is just sitting securely. Securely not in the sense of great defenses. They're like just not expecting to be attacked. If you think of in Sidom, Vayavo al ha'ir betach, right? Shimon Levi attack the city and the city is unsuspecting. Assuming Betach describes the city. Kimishpat Sidonim. They were like the Sidonim. Shoket uvoteach. Quiet. Just trusting that everything's going to be fine. Nice, peaceful people. Ve'ed machlim davar ba'aretz yoresh etzer. That is a hard phrase to translate. I'm curious to see what you do, what your translations do with it. What do you do with the phrase ve'ein machlim davar ba'aretz yoresh etzer? There are like three different ways you can take this.
There was no night in the land to put them to shame for anything.
And the next part of it, after that?
Their heirs being few.
Their heirs being few. So one way to take it is, there is no leader in there. There's no leader there in the land to rebuke them, essentially. The word machlim suggests shame, klima. So there's no one there, and they had few heirs. I don't understand why that's relevant to what's going on, but that's one way to take it. What do you have, Alina, in the art scroll?
No issue in the land could cause them embarrassment, and there was no heir to the dynasty.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so there's no heir to the dynasty, and there's no issue in the land could cause embarrassment. I don't even know what that means. That's a wall of trend? No, Elaine, what do you... No, sorry.
Mine says, for there was none in the land possessing authority that might put them to shame in anything, and they were far from the Sidonim.
Okay, well, far from the Sidonim is the next phrase, but okay.
Also, it says, no one would come to their defense, also.
That's the next piece. That's not on this. So there is no something. There is no machlim. And Yoresh Etzer, which is a very odd phrase, Urchokim Hema Mitzidonim, they're far from Sidon, meaning, therefore, Sidon isn't going to come to their defense. V'davar Ein Lahem Madam, and they have no deals with anybody. They have no communication with anybody else. They're pigeons. That's what it is.
Easy target.
Yeah. Sarava Eshtol. So they go back home. The five men. They go back home to Tzara and Eshtol. Vayamru lahem achayem ma'atem. And the brothers say, ma'atem. Ma'atem sounds like it means,
what are you?
We know what they are. So ma'atem can't mean what are you. Rather, ma'atem means what do you have to say. Right? If you think of when Rus comes home from her conversation with Boaz, right? And Naomi says to her, mi'at biti. Right? Who are you, my daughter? It's that kind of a thing. I mean, who are you? I know exactly who you are. But what's happened? Vayomaru, and they said, Kuma v'na'ale aleihem. Get up, let's go. Ki ra'inu es ha'aretz. We've seen the land. V'hine tova me'od. It's great land. V'atem machshim. And here you are, just either machshim being very silent, or being very sedentary. You're not doing anything. Al te'ad salu. Don't be lazy. L'leches l'avo l'resh es ha'aretz. To go take this land. Kivoachem tavo el amboteach. You're going to arrive in a land where the nation is just confident that everything is fine. They're quiet. V'aretz rachvas yadayim. The land is very broad. So apparently they say there's a lot of land. Kinesana elokim bi'echem. God has given it into your hands. No word which God this is. Makom asher in sham machsor. A place where nothing is lacking. Kol davar asher ba'aretz. Whatever you want, it's there. That is the report. Okay, So there's a lot here that's just, especially in Pasuk Zayin, that requires explanation. This business about Ein Machlim Davar Baaretz Yerish Etzer. But first of all, Leshem in Yehoshua becomes Laish here. So the standard approach is to say that happened. All sorts of names change in small ways. Yeah, something like that. All names change in small ways in Tanakh. It happens with people's names, it happens with place names. Don't get hung up on it. But Rashi quotes a very interesting medrash which takes a side in the debate of whether they were supposed to take this land or not. Take a look at source number 7. Ubesefer Yehoshua Koreshma Leshem. Al Shem Shemats Usham Eben Tova Sheshma Leshem. In Yeshua, they called it Leshem because they found a gem there called Leshem. The Hiyai Salah Hoshem Leshevet Dan. On the Kohen Gadol's breastplate, you have 12 stones, one for each tribe, right? And Vatur HaShalishi, the third row, is Leshem Shavo Ve'achlama. So Leshem is the first one. They actually, the place was always called Laish. But they found a Leshem stone there, and that was important to them because that is Dun's stone on the Choshen. And therefore, Shmoka Suva Leshem V'yadusha Be'emes Hinach Lazam. They said, that's it. Now we know this is really ours. It's a sign from God. That's really important because Rashi's Medrash is taking the view that they were supposed to take this land. Whereas many other voices in this say, no, this was actually inappropriate. They were supposed to take their original land first. Maybe this was land that's outside of Eretz Yisrael, and therefore they don't belong here at all until they've settled the land that's been given to them. So that's an important point, is, you know, taking that that idea. But in terms of the comparison here, they're like the Tzidonim. What does it mean that you're like the Tzidonim? So the Saradak says, in number 8, is that the Sidonim had nothing to fear from us. They were just peaceful. Sidon, Sor and Sidon are the two major Lebanese cities that you encounter in Tanakh. The Hiram is the king of Sor, right? Hiram who provides the cedars for the Beis HaMikdash. But Sor and Sidon, you see them all the time. Had Sidonim, Radak says, Hayu Krovim Laretz Yisrael, they were close to Israel. But you Shoktim, they were quiet. Kilo Hayu Rotzim Lilachem Imahem, Kilo Hayu Meretz Kenan. They didn't want to fight with them. Unclear in these pronouns whether he means they didn't want to fight us, because they weren't from Canaan anyway, so they didn't care. Or we didn't want to fight them, because again, we had no reason to fight them. They weren't, you know, in our land. Bless you. But either way, they are like the Tzidonim, in the sense that they're at peace. They're not a threat. Ein machlim davar ba'aretz yoresh etzer. Now we get to these difficult phrases. So I'm going to offer a couple of different ways to take it. Rashi says machlim is to embarrass, and it means they didn't need to ask for anything and get turned down. They had no needs. They had everything they wanted. Rashi, I think, is based on a pasuk in Shmuel. If you remember the story of David and Nabal, and how David's men have taken care of Nabal's shepherds, and they were never machlim them, they never shamed them, turning them away or doing anything to upset them. So that's one take, is there is no machlim, they never get turned down. Radak says they had no one to fear among their neighbors, and then you get Ralbag and Abarbanel, who take the view that your translations seem to take. There is no king to rebuke them. Now,
that means that they shouldn't have done it. There's no one to tell them.
Well, no king to rebuke the people of Leshem, slash Laish. There's no king to rebuke them, but what we care about is, and therefore there's no king to lead them in battle.
Yeah. Right.
But I brought you here just because I couldn't resist. Look what Abarbanel does. He does this funny little line about democracy. He says, V'achshov, you know what I think? Shet Sidonim, the Tzidonim, because these people are like the Tzidonim, so it's the Tzidonim and the people of Laish Leshem. Hayu anashim socharim. They were merchants. Misnagim tamid ba'anagos tavos b'li melech. And they always acted nicely without a king. Kemosha od hayom osim, just like today they do. Ha Venetianush, remember he's the end of the 15th century, the Venetians. Ha Florentinush, the Florentines. And I didn't know what the Zenobishush are. I need to know more about Italian geography from the period. But some other group. Ushar ha'amim asher beretz Italia and the other nations in Italy. Omdim bihanago sayam b'liam lachas melech besocham. They act just fine without a king over them. Remember, he's living in Spain at this point, under Ferdinand. So he says, you know, those Italians, they have it right. They're not like the Spaniards. So that's what's going on here. It's a nice, peaceful, well-mannered nation. What I think about, though, when I read that, is that there's another layer to what Abarbanel is talking about. Think about this a little bit. What is Abarbanel saying is true for the people of Sidon and Laish?
They pass through borders easily. The merchants usually travel at that time.
This is true, but on a basic level. On a basic level. More basic. That's a good point, but it's more basic than that. They have no king, and yet they do just fine. Right. As opposed to a melech b'Yisrael, right? We don't have a king, and we get into all sorts of trouble.
Right. They're living properly without it.
Exactly. So I think the idea of ein machlim, there's no king, and yet they're doing just fine, is another slam on us.
That we are.
Exactly.
That we can't. Well, the merchants would be selling spices and essentials, let's say, to people who want those items. So it's not like selling a fur coat to someone who doesn't really need it.
Right.
But their whole society is
prosperous as well.
Yeah. Well, we assume so anyway. I mean, you can be a peddler and be a merchant too.
Yeah, that's what.
And Yoresh Eitzer. So this is difficult because it's not clear whether the word Ein from before Machlim applies to the Yoresh Eitzer or not. There is no Yoresh Eitzer or there is a Yoresh Eitzer. So the Dan Mikra suggests and Abarbanel suggests Yoresh Eitzer means an inherited ruler. And what he's saying is there is none, Ein. There is no Machlim, there is no Yoresh Eitzer, there's no ruler. The other way to take it is that it's not from the word Ein. It's there is Yoresh Eitzer, and Eitzer means small. Eitzer means something small, like the Efes Atzur V'Azuv. And so the idea is that there are very few people who are their heirs, meaning if Dan comes and conquers the land, there's nobody who's going to do anything about it. Yeah. I don't want to spend a lot of time on the word by word, because there's so much to see in terms of the message, but it is important to know how to read a pasuk. The message here that we're supposed to learn from this is the vulnerability of the population. Here they are without a leader, if we take it that way, or with all their needs met, either way. Here they are without allies. They're far from Sidon. They have no one who has made any sort of covenant with them to protect them. They have no heirs who are going to come after you for what you've done to them. It's a pigeon. It's just like, you know, that's our mark right there. We can attack. And they come back and they give this really enthusiastic report. They say to the people, why are you wasting time? The land is great. It's all available. Notice also the turn of phrase that's used when they give their report. Two phrases here appear in Chumash. Go back to Pasuk Tes. It's really Tes and Yud. One phrase in Pasuk Tes, one phrase in Pasuk Yud. Hinei tova me'od, right? As in tova ha'aretz, me'od, me'od, when Yeshua and Kalev want to convince the Jews to come to the land. And then in Yud, from last week's Parsha. Yeah, v'aretz rachavas yadayim. That's what the people of Shechem said regarding the Jews coming to settle in the land. The land is rachvas yadayim lifnehem. It's wide open in front of them. So he uses that. This is Hamor speaking to Shechem. He uses it to persuade them that they should go along with the deal with the Jews and do the bris milah. So in other words, this is language that's used for persuasion.
Why are you telling them? Get up, what are you waiting for? They were waiting for them to come back with a report.
Right, but they were like, come on, let's go.
Yeah.
But the other thing here, and the major thing that I think to see, is that they act out of what motivation? What's motivating them to go take this land?
How easy it is? How easy it will
be? No, but what's driving this?
They want more land.
It's greed. It's greed. Look, everything you ever wanted is all there. The land is good. You can get whatever you like. There's no nation to stop us. Let's do it. that wasn't supposed to be the motivation in battling Canaan. Right? We were sent into this land because Hashem was angry about what the Canaanim were doing there. It was never about, let's give the Jews a nice homeland and a place to stay. It was always about get rid of Canaan. And then, okay, they're descendants of Abraham and Sarah and all that, so they get this land. But it was fundamentally about demolishing the immoral Canaanite society, and instead, what are we doing? We're going outside of Israel, right? According to most views, again, leaving that Rashi on the side about it, we're going outside of Israel, we're fighting a war with people who are not Canaanim, in order to get wealthy.
They're not
peaceful, they're nice, peaceful people, and by the way, managed just fine without a king.
And they would be good neighbors.
Yeah. So it's just like, that's what I meant when I said to you, like, this is the dull part of the story in the sense that there are no, you know, Micha is gone and the Levi's not here, and so where's the entertainment? But this is a major lesson in terms of what's the fault that's being found in the Jews in this story.
It was a sort of political mistake as well, because they made enemies of people who would have been allies.
Actually, they got away with it. Yeah, that's the next part here. They're going to manage just fine. But take a look now at what happens next, because now we get back into this, Micha's coming back into the story, the Levi's coming back into the story, and this is just truly strange. Pasuk Yud Aleph. Vayisu misham mimishpachas hadani mitzara'u me'eshtol sheish me'os ish chagur klei milchama. So, from Dan, from the families of Dan, they traveled from Tzara'at, from Eshtol, 600 men wearing weapons. 600 men doesn't sound like a very large number, right? If you remember way, way back.
Yeah.
I mean, this is nothing. This is like appetizer for Shimshon.
But if they're going to take over a peaceful country where there isn't any defense, they don't need
correct.
More.
Correct. They don't think they need more. Yeah. But like, if you remember Gideon with his war with Midian, he starts out with 30,000 or 33,000 people, and Hashem makes him pare it down until he's down to 300. And Gideon's like, well, now what? Now what do I do? And Hashem says, don't worry, it's a miracle. I'll take care of you. But like 600 men to fight a city, the answer is they're just really confident.
So are they expecting a miracle then?
Maybe, but maybe they just think it's not even necessary. Yeah, sorry?
I'm saying they're such a big tribe, it's not like they had a lack of people.
Yeah, they could have had more. They're a very large shevet. So this is strange, but there's something else in this pasuk that stands out as well. So maybe we'll come back to that. We'll see. Vayalu, Pasuk Yud Bet, sentence 12. Vayalu vayachanu b'Kiryat Yearim b'Yehuda. They go and camp in Kiryat Yearim in Yehuda. Al kein karu l'makom ahu machane Dan ad hayom hazeh. Therefore they called this the camp of Dan until this day. Hine acharei Kiryat Yearim. It's behind Kiryat Yearim. You know that place? That's why it's called Machane Dan. Okay. Vayavru misham Har Ephraim, and they go to Har Ephraim. Vayavo ad Beis Micha. Lo and behold, let's go to the house of Micha, because why not? Let's go to the house of Micha. Well, we're going
to
find out.
To the house of Micha.
Yes, but also because of what's coming next. But what I think is really interesting in these psukim, I guess we will note it here. Go back to Pasuk Yud Aleph. What stands out? What detail stands out here?
Weapons?
Yeah, the weapons. No. Have we ever had weapons in this entire book?
No.
Never. We had the cattle goat of Shamgar ben Anat. We had the jawbone that Shimshon used. Mm-hmm. Right? You had the lefty dagger that Ehud ben Gera had.
Because that was just one man, one person.
But even when they were under Canaan, we said that they had no weapons. They didn't have the chariots, they didn't have the weapons. It's been a consistent theme in this Sefer that we don't have the weaponry. Here we do. It's just one more way in which we have become like Canaan. You know, now we're there with weapons, and hey, we just need to bring 600 people because we have weapons. Don't worry about it. That, I think, is what's going on here. Okay. So we go to this Micha's house. Now watch what happens. Vayanu chameshes ha'anashim ha'ochim l'ragelas ha'aretz layish. So the five men who had gone on the original reconnaissance trip, they declared vayamur alachayim. They told their brothers, "Hayidatem, did you know ki yesh babatim ha'ela efod u'trafim u'pesel u'masecha? in this area, among these houses, there's actually a place where they have the ephod of the teraphim, the statue, the molten form, the whole bit. Ve'ata de'uma ta'asu. You know what to do. Okay. Vayasuru shama, they went there. Vayavo, based on Nar Halevi, based Micha. They go to the house where this Nar Halevi is, the house of Micha. Vayashalu lo shalom. They ask, how you doing? Vishesh meos ish chagurim klei milcham tam. And 600 men are wearing their weapons. Nitzavim pesach hashar asher bibnei don. And they're hanging out at the gate. Vayalu chamesha sa'anashim ha'ochim l'ragela sa'aret ba'u shama. And the five men go into the house. And they steal the statue, they steal the ephod jacket, they steal the trafim, they steal the molten form, everything. While the Kohen is standing out front with the 600 people who, once again, this is like the third time now, right? We're highlighting the fact that they have weapons. And they came into the house of Micha. Ela meaning these five. They took all this stuff, right, which we know from the previous pasuk, but it's just setting us, it's setting up the conversation that's about to happen. And the Kohen says, wait a minute, what are you doing? You're clearing out all the stuff. You're taking everything. Now, if you're the Kohen, what do you do at this point with the 600 armed men?
Not much.
I don't know. I mean, you go to Micha, you cower inside, right? It's unclear what your reaction is. Well, watch this. They said to him, they said, be quiet. Put your hand on your mouth, which is a phrase we find elsewhere in Nach, of an expression of I'm not going to say anything, or you know, something along those lines. So that's what they say you should do, exactly. Come with us. You should be a father and a Kohen with us. Hatova Yosef.
No.
That's it. This is an upgrade.
We found a Kohen on the way. Yeah. We want him.
Hatova Yosef Kohen. Look, he's easy. He cost them 10 kesef a year. 10 kesef a year. A change of clothing and food. That was all he needed. The Hatova Yosef Kohen, the Beis Yishe Chad. Is it better for you to be a Kohen for one house, or one man? Oh, Yosef Kohen, the Shevet El Mishpacha of Yisrael. Or you could be a Kohen of an entire tribe, an entire family. This is great. Mahitav Leva Kohen. So that he says, yeah, that sounds like a good idea. He's a careerist.
Doesn't say they're offering him more money.
No. It's stature, exactly. Notice that language in Pasukah. He takes it himself. That's true. But it isn't even like, you know, they take the stuff. He takes it. He takes it himself. Well, Micha, on the other hand, is not going to be happy. Right? Because Micha's invested here. So, Vayifnu Vayilechu, they turned and left. And they put the children, the cattle, the wealth. There are different explanations for whether it means wealth or whether it means utensils or heavy stuff. Everything is in front of them. That's what I thought also. So one of the questions is, what are you doing with children?
Way back here, it said that they were the 600 men plus their families.
It said they came from their families.
No.
Really?
Yep.
Let's go back and look. It said, no, mi mishpachas hadani. Were you looking at Pasuk Yirala?
From families.
You're looking at sentence 11. Yeah, I don't think it mentioned. It's very unusual to bring children to war. That's one of the questions we're going to have to ask here is, what are these kids doing?
At the beginning. They said 600 army warriors accompanied by their women and children, their flocks, and all their belongings.
Wait, what pasuk are you on?
1126. I'm looking in the English.
You're looking at the Rashi.
Oh, well, that's right.
Thank you. Yeah. Okay. No, the pasuk didn't say anything about it. Rashi's saying it because he got to our pasuk and he said there are children there. But where did what is this about?
This one. Joseph Karos says it.
Yeah, we'll get there.
Oh, okay.
We'll get there. So that's a question that we have to ask here is, why are there children there? And it's a very important point. But they get far from Micha's house. And the people who are in the houses around there are all summoned. They rally, but Biku has B'nai Dan, and they run after B'nai Dan, and they catch up to them. V'kuril B'nai Dan, and they call to the Danites. V'yasevu B'naihem, and the Danites turn around with their weapons. V'yamru L'micha, they said to Micha, Malacha kinizachta, what's all this fuss about? Why are you? V'yomer, and he said, Es Elohai asher asisi l'kachtem, you stole my God. Right, the God I made. V'has ha-kohen, and the Kohen. V'telchu, and you left. Umali od, what do I have now? Umaze tamur elai malach. What are you asking me? What are you? You know exactly what I'm... It's bizarre. V'yomu elav b'nei Dan. Well, the people of Dan say back to them, Al tashma kol chayimanu. Don't raise your voice to us. Don't do that. Pen yivgu b'chem anashim marei nefesh. There are some very angry people here. We have bad tempers, and you might get hurt. And then you will be responsible for what happens to you and your family. And they threaten him. If you look at verse 11, the Radak, he says, you're going to cause everybody to die. You make your voice heard, and you keep speaking of this. They all go on their way. Micha says, oh well, they're stronger than I am. They sell and he goes home. It's such a bizarre story, but it just contributes again to this idea of the lawlessness that you have. It's just, you know, might makes right. I guess they're bigger than I am, so, you know, they win.
Is that the last we hear of Micha?
And that's the last we're going to hear of Micha. We're not done with Dan, so to speak. That was not intended. There's more to happen with them. But in terms of the kids, take a look at source number 10, please. This is Radak. He says, Elu sheshmeos ish hagur klei milchama, these 600 men, girded with their weapons, im tapam unshehem umigdehem, they went with their children, their wives, their cattle, halchu, they went with all of that, kayu betuchim sheilach du ha'ir, they were sure they would take the city, because after all, we have weapons and they're, you know, nothing, right? It's not even that they're confident, you know, because of God, they're confident because of themselves. And it reminds us of the beginning of Sefer Yehoshua and the war with Ai. After the defeat of Yericho, they go out to war with Ai, and they're sure that they're going to win, and this is easy, you don't need to bring everybody and all that. That's what we've come to, is this stage in which, sure, we can win, no problem, let's bring the kids along. You know, we're just moving everything, and we'll just move up there.
It's also very long, it's very far away, so...
Yeah, it is far away, it's end to end, really. Yeah.
But this doesn't echo way Ai.
This does not end the way I ended. I ended with a disaster. And this, they did just fine.
Yeah.
As we'll see, and this will be in the next sukkah, but I guess what we'll do is next time, God willing, we'll wrap up this parak, talk more about Moshe and Avodah Zarah before getting started on Pilegish B'Givah. God willing.